so many people that I've come across who, when they ask me about what I believe and I share it with them, they tell me that when they were growing up, whether they grew up in a church or outside of a church and they don't know anything about the Bible, but anytime that they ask questions, a lot of the time they were told either, because I said so, or because it's in the Bible, or stop asking so many questions. And so I really wanted to be able to create this series that helped to answer questions, and kind of as a subtitle under why, it's because we're not afraid of the hard questions. And I want people to realize that it's okay to ask questions in today's world, and especially about religion. If we're not asking questions about the Bible and what it teaches, how are we going to learn? And how are we going to find out what the truth is? Because, let's be frank, this book has been used for a lot of bad things. And if we're not asking the questions of why is it that way, we're not going to find the answers. So before we get started, how it's going to work is that each night we're going to start off with about 10 minutes or so of what we're calling a special feature. Loretta tonight will be sharing her testimony with us before we get started with everything else. So, Loretta.
Hello and welcome, everybody. I would like to start out with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, I just pray in your holy precious name that you touch every single heart here. They're searching. They're here for a reason. It's by no accident, God. I just ask that you bless them. Keep all distractions away from them. Help them to learn about your precious love. In Jesus Christ's name, amen. So my name is Loretta Adkinson, and sometimes life is different for all. Some of you grew up in Christians' homes. Some of us didn't. This is my testimony to give honor and glory to God, who changed my life. I grew up in a non-Christian home. My childhood was full of a lot of abuse from my mother. By the time I was 15, my father died, and I started drinking and using drugs. As I grew up, things became worse. I was abused as a child from all these things. I had panic attacks. I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress syndrome, which Vietnam vets are diagnosed because of the severe things they've seen. I was shy, where I couldn't look anyone in the eye. I couldn't talk to anybody. I had no hope. I had severe depression, no self-esteem. I hated myself. I hated a lot of people. I was a severe alcoholic 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, using meth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I smoked 2 or more packs of cigarettes a day. I was suicidal by the time I was 10 years old. I tried to kill myself. I did not believe in God. I did not believe in Jesus Christ. I did not believe in this at all. I didn't believe there was heaven. I didn't believe there was a hell. Then one day, I was tired of my life, and I just remembered, I was just sick of it. I looked at myself, and from the drugs and the meth, I was just covered, my whole body with scabs. I looked just disgusting. I hated myself. I thought I was ugly. I got a gun. I loaded the gun, and I remembered screaming and crying and cussing. If there is somebody up there, show me. Show me you're real in 12 hours or less, or I'm going to kill myself. And I had called somebody that I was seeing and had them pick me up. And we were driving, and somebody started chasing us. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't understand that what was going to happen and how my life was going to change. And we came up to a corner, and it was a sharp corner. And from here to where that chair is, there was a fence. We were doing 95 miles an hour. And I looked up, and I knew that was it. We were going to be dead. And everything went black. like as if you go to sleep in a deep sleep and you don't know anything. You're like it. You're just sleeping, like you're dead. And all of a sudden, this was at 9 o'clock at night, so it was dark. Then all of a sudden, everything, my eyes opened, and the car was floating. And everything was bright and beautiful. And I felt this love I've never felt in my life. Touch me and fill my whole body. And I thought we were in heaven. I remember saying, we're in heaven, we're in heaven. It was so bright, it was so beautiful. And a few more things happened, but I remember saying, I didn't want to do this to my daughters. I need to go back. I don't want my daughters to worry about me. And the car from where we should have hit, but we didn't, a quarter mile away, came from out of the air and fell and slammed onto the road. And I threw up my hands and I said, there's a God. There's a God. And he told me, this is true from the front to the back, and to follow my commandments, to live a holy life. And I remember thinking, what? How can I? I'm a drug addict. I'm an alcoholic. What do I do? What? This is not possible. He said, trust in me. So I decided to do that. And I ran home and grabbed a Bible, a big, huge, like, 100-year-old Bible. And I just knew it was true and there was something good in there. And I start reading it. And the Holy Spirit just touched my heart and start changing my life. So through that, God gave me some Bible verses for my life, which is Philippians 4:13. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I cannot do this. I didn't do this. Only with Jesus Christ did this happen. And also, to keep me going, too, of Philippians 1:6. Being confident of this very thing which he has begun, a good work in you will perform it until the day of Jesus Christ. So now I know no matter what happens and what I go through, God's going to be there with me until the very end. And then I love 2 Corinthians 17. Therefore, if any man, and just because it says man, he's talking about women too, be in Christ, which I am now, he is a new creature, so I'm a new person. I'm not that old person. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things become new. I'm not a drug addict anymore. I'm not an alcoholic anymore. Where people say, oh, I'm an alcoholic, I hear that, and that just breaks my heart thinking, if you have Jesus, he takes it away. I have no more cravings absolutely whatsoever for any of those things. He took it away from me instantly. I didn't go through rehab. I didn't go to a hospital and have to be hooked up to needles to get me through, to save me. God did it. God did it. And then as I moved into this drug neighborhood, God put me there. He had me preaching to people about Jesus Christ. And, you know, only he can do those things. And I got to share so much with these people. And that didn't come from me because I didn't even believe in him. So I'm a little nervous, so excuse me. So the other day I found a magazine, and I hang this up beside my bed. I got it out of called The Gleaner, a magazine I receive in the mail. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you, not to harm you. plans to give you a hope and a future. Jeremiah 29:11. And then I wanted to share about my mother who abused us severely, and she wasn't Christian. Just before she died, I was living with her. And she started doing Bible study, and she kept asking me to do Bible study. I'm like, no, Mom, stop that. You know, I don't believe in that stuff. It's weird. Christians are weirdos. Stop. Leave me alone. Stop it. I can't take it. Leave me alone. And she kept saying that she loved us, and she loved us, and I didn't understand why she was getting so sweet. I didn't understand it was Jesus in her. So I'm just happy to say today that I'll have my mother. When I get to heaven, the loving mom I've always wanted, because she's been forgiven of her sins because she accepted Jesus Christ. There's nothing too big for God. I don't care what it is. If you killed somebody, if you molested a child, if you're a drug addict, if you're an alcoholic, sin is sin. It sounds terrible that someone could do that to a small little child. But in God's eyes, God don't like the act, but he loves that person and he wants to save them. So I'm just here to say, don't give up, no matter what it is. Keep on praying. And the last one I'd like to share is, I was smoking cigarettes. This was a year after, in 2006, and I was witnessing to my neighbors. And I remembered just thinking, how can I do this? I love Jesus. How good does this look if I'm smoking this cigarette and puffing out and trying to share God with something wasn't right? God was convicting my heart. This isn't right. This is not right. And so I had one cigarette left, and I got on my knees on the floor, and I said, Lord, you took the meth from me. You took the alcohol from me. You can do this too. Don't let me have no withdrawals. Give me the strength and cleanse all this filth out of my body, all of it. And I got up, and that is the last cigarette I had since February 6th of 2006. I did not suffer any withdrawals of any of the drugs or the cigarettes or the alcohol at all. That's impossible for anybody sitting here to do on their own. And I believe, too, if someone just quit and they didn't even know God, someone's been praying for that person. And God just told me we're living in the end times. He took me to the end of the book of Revelation and told me we're living in the end times. First of all, I didn't even step foot in a church yet until he shared that with me. He shared that with me. I said, cling to God, cling to the Bible, and pray before you open it, you read it, and it will change your life. You deserve it, everyone. I love everyone here. I don't even know you two. I've never met you. I care. I care to see you in heaven. You deserve it. Thank you.
Thank you, Loretta. All right, does everyone have their handouts? All right, this is what we're going to be using most of the time. Well, I'm going to be making them for every single night that you guys come, so that I know that not everyone has a Bible, and if you don't, we have some for you in the foyer. But just to make it easy for us to be able to flow, there's a lot of stuff to cover every night. So we're going to be going through here and using these verses here and give you some context along with it. So as I told you, the series is supposed to be focusing on the question, why? And so every night there's going to be a different question for us to answer. For the first two nights, we're going to be answering the same question now with subcategories. And that is, why believe in Jesus? Can you guys tell me, what are Christians known for today? Preaching? Anything else? Judgmental? Inconsistent? What have Christians done historically? Hurt people? Talk to me. This is your time. Built a country? Okay. Have any of you heard of the book Unchristian? You have. You have a copy. All right. Very good. This is a book that's not a book of, you know, storyline here, there. It's a book of statistics. And it's not for every person to read. But it's a book that was done under the premise of what do people believe about Christians. Now, it used both Christians and non-Christians in the book and the statistics. But interestingly enough, the words humble, servant, and love didn't even break the top 10 or top 100 words used to describe Christians. In fact, we were viewed so lowly that we were rated one step above that of prostitutes. Does that hurt a little bit if you're Christian? Statistics like greed and gluttony, or living in excess, Christians were voted for to be just as prone to them as non-Christians. Violence, self-righteousness, all the same, just as equally prone to those things. And then when it comes to marriage, one of the things that Christianity today is really taking a fight for, you know, marriage, we're going to save marriage. We're more prone to divorce than non-Christians. We're claiming to God, to know God, to stand for truth and righteousness, and yet the rest of the world has a completely different image of us. We don't have a good reputation, so why should we be called Christians? So we're taking a look at the man behind the name, Jesus. Tonight we're going to be looking at why should we believe in him? And tonight's message is that it's because he's a man worth following. Even if the Christian religion has been used in various ways and has been marred by individuals throughout history, Jesus was a man worth following. Mahatma Gandhi gave us a quote. He said, "I like your Christ. I do not like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ." Kind of sums it up. But tonight we're going to take a look at Luke chapter 14. And we're going to look at this story of Jesus and to see what kind of man he really was, all right? Now, it says, Luke chapter 14, verse 1, "One Sabbath, when Jesus was to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched." So, whose house is he eating in? A Pharisee's house, right? Now, a number of chapters before, he had been asked in Luke 5, "Why do you eat with tax collectors and sinners?" A Pharisee asked him this question. Why do you eat with tax collectors and sinners? Why do you think he would have been asked that question? Because he did it. Who were the tax collectors and sinners? The people that the religious folk looked down on. See, back then, eating was not like it is today. You didn't just drive through McDonald's or Taco Bell and go on your way. Eat who you ate with. It was a social event. If I ate with you, I would be saying, "You're my people." And if Jesus, a rabbi, a teacher, someone who is viewed with high moral character, is eating with tax collectors and sinners? What was he saying? I'm one of you. You're one. I'm your people. You're my people. It wasn't a socially identified you with who they were, saying, you're my tribe. Now here, the nice thing is that in Luke chapter 14, it says that Jesus went to eat at the house of a prominent Pharisee. So who is he eating with now? Pharisees and sinners and tax collectors. Was he discriminating against anyone? No. But he was being carefully watched because the Pharisees didn't like what he did. It says that there in front of him was a man suffering from abnormal swelling of his body, or edema in some versions. Where did this guy come from? He's at the Pharisee's house, but he's obviously not doing well. The thing about the Jews is that to them, people who were sinners were the poor, the destitute, the lame, the sick. How you manifested outwardly reflected who you were inwardly, because God was paying you for what you had done. You were deserving of it. And so when he was accused of eating with sinners, he was eating with these people that were lame, sick. But he's being watched, and he knows what's going on with them. And do you know what day of the week this was? What day did it say? Sabbath. Jesus asked the Pharisees and experts in the law, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? Now, in another occasion, one of my favorites, he also asks another question on the Sabbath in the synagogue. He asks, is it lawful to do good or to do evil on the Sabbath? And I really like that version a little bit more, simply because, well, how many people in here are parents? Okay, I'm not yet. I have a chihuahua, but that's not counting for this scenario. Those of you who are parents, if you have a kid that is acting out, what's one of the best ways to handle that situation? You can put them in time out, but are they going to learn anything? Robin? Okay, if you ignore it. I don't think that would apply to the Pharisees here. They tried ignoring him, and he went ahead and healed the man, as we'll see. But if you're a parent and your kids are playing with something that they shouldn't play with, you might say, okay, you can go play outside, or you can read a book. And you can give them options, right? So he gives the Pharisees options in that case. Can you do good or can you do evil? Is there a middle ground? Is there a do nothing, sit back and sleep? Not in this case. He says do good or do evil. You can only do one or the other. There is no middle ground. There is no lukewarmness. And so Jesus here asks them, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? Which one is doing good? Healing is doing good, right? They don't answer because they know it's a trick question. It says they remain silent. So taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him on his way. Then he turned to them and said, if one of you has a child or an ox that falls into the well on the Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull it out? And what did they have to say to that? The first time he asked a question, they didn't answer. Why didn't they answer? Were they afraid the first time? Or were they just trying to trip him? And the second time, I think they really were just tongue-tied. So then Jesus said to his host, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or sisters, your relatives, or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, so you will be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Now, as we said before, who were these people? Sinners. They were people that were looked down upon as being morally inferior to themselves. It's really, really important to note this. You see the note over on the left. Deuteronomy 28 describes the poor, the crippled, lame, and blind as they were seen as being deserving of their fate because of their past sins. It's not a social standing anymore. It's a moral issue, a moral compass and level, rating system, judging system. Whereas the confidence of the Pharisees was based on what? The Pharisees were the religious leaders of the day. They were well enough off financially, and they were healthy. So where does their confidence, their knowledge of salvation come from? Rules and regulations, it's based on religion. Nationalism, they were Jews, right? Their health and their wealth. But let's notice what Jesus does with this parable. He says, invite them, the poor, crippled, lame, and blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. Now, the rules and regulations of Moses' time were focused around what? Huh? Sacrifices, offerings. So traditions. That had meaning to them. Very important for their meaning and understanding. But they got caught up in the do not of the world. The do nots. Thou shalt not. Thou shalt not. And even when it came to the Sabbath, thou shalt remember the Sabbath day. They turned it into a list of, you can't do this. You can't do that. You can't walk far. Did you know that they had a rule about how far you could walk on the Sabbath? Once you reached that point, you'd sit down. And you'd have to sit there until the sun went down. Yes. He did. He absolutely did. But he also said do. It's about doing evil versus doing good. But there's always something to do. Idle hands are the devil's playthings. And so we see, as in the case with the man that he healed, that the Pharisees are about the letter of the law, while Jesus was about the heart of the law. The idea behind the law. Why is it there? It's for the betterment of all of us. So Q&A time. Have you ever been in a situation where someone felt morally superior to you and let you know it? Where someone judged you for doing something? Yeah? Okay, a little bit more honest now. Have you ever been in a situation where you felt morally superior to someone else, whether you told them or not? A few times? Maybe? We won't talk about that. Oh, just wait until after the talk when we get together. Fellowship time. So he says to invite them. And then everyone kind of gets a little bit nervous here. They're a bunch of Pharisees. To them, what is Jesus saying? Go out and invite those people that you feel you are morally superior to. See, now you really have to feel what they are feeling, because it's not the same as it is today. When we see someone homeless or crippled or a vet who lost their leg in a war, what do we feel when we see those people? If you're a good person, sympathy, compassion. You want to help. That's not how they felt back then. If you were crippled like that or homeless, you deserved it. Everyone teaches have compassion on those who are less fortunate, but they weren't seen as less fortunate. Even if you were born blind, it was because of the sins of your fathers and you still deserve it. Or because God knew you would sin and is punishing you ahead of time. So it wasn't an issue of having compassion on the less fortunate. What was radical about Jesus is that he said that whomever you feel you are morally superior to, whomever you judge and whom you feel you don't fit in with, make them your tribe. Can you think of a people today that Christianity has pointed out as being morally inferior on a large scale? Can you think of a group of people? Talk to me. Homosexuals, absolutely. Their community has been pinpointed. Do you know how many times the Bible speaks out against it? Now, don't get me wrong. You know, where you stand on whether or not it's a sin is a different issue, because we all have sins. But what does Jesus say to do with them? It says make them your people. Get to know them. Talk to them. Don't judge them. Don't tell them what they're doing wrong. He says invite them over. Dine with them. When one of those at the table with him heard this is the peacekeeper, Pharisee. When one of them at the table heard this, you kind of have to imagine him trying to change the topic, because they're feeling a little uncomfortable about this idea, and some of us here, maybe even myself a little bit, can feel a little uncomfortable at the same time. And he says, blessed are those who will eat at the feast of the kingdom of God. So those people who will be invited to God's kingdom. And Jesus says, well, okay, let me tell you about God's kingdom. I know a thing or two about it. Jesus says, a certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. Now, a certain man that can do that, he's got to be a man of wealth and power. Can you agree? And so he would have been seen as morally superior. He invites many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, come, for everything is now ready. But they all alike began to make excuses. And I really want you to notice these excuses. The first said, I have just bought a field, and I must go see to it. When is the right time to do due diligence? Before you buy it. Thank you. Second person. Another said, I have just bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I'm on my way to try them out. When do you test drive a car? Before you buy it. Thank you. All right. Still another said, I just got married, so I can't come. I can kind of understand that. But bring her along. The servant came back and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and ordered his servant, go out quickly into the streets and alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. Sir, the servant said, what you ordered has been done, but there is still room. So Sir, the servant said, what you ordered has been done, but there is still room. Then the master told his servant, go out to the roads and country lands and compel them to come in so that my house will be full. What's the message here? Told in those last few words, what is the man's or God's wish? He just wants his house full. He doesn't care who fills it. So long as they want to be there, they're welcome. The next verse, Isaiah 51:5, really spells it out for you. Come, all you who are thirsty, come to the waters. And you who have no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. He just wants to feed people. He just wants his house full. But I really want you to notice something about this word compel. The story of Christ, the reason why he came, goes way back. And most of us here, I think, probably believe in the creation story. But whether or not you do, you kind of have to go back there to at least understand the concept of what sin is and how it came about. And we're going to be really touching on that a lot more. But in a nutshell, it comes down to two people who turned away from God. Not God away from them. They turned away from God. And since that time, God has always been trying to get us to turn back to him. Many have tried to turn it into take Martin Luther, not King, but Martin Luther, for instance. He'd sit there whipping himself regularly, trying to pay penance, trying to get God to turn back to him. And that's the message that so many people have about who God is and his character. It all started with a lie. His character was marred, and that's why they turned away from him. But God has a message that he wants all of us to come back to him. Jesus was that messenger. This word compel, it's one of the most twisted words in history, in the Christian history. Up until about the 4th century, what did it mean? It says over here, compel means it did not mean to coerce or to force. It meant to plead or to beg on your knees. And who was the servant to compel, to beg and plead with? Everyone, the people on the country roads, the poor, the crippled. Why would they need to be compelled to come to a banquet feast? They wouldn't feel worthy, okay? Well, even if maybe they personally felt like they should deserve that, why would they have reason to be reticent, to be worried? Nice clothes, okay. Worried about how they look or smell? What if we go back to the very beginning of this story? The man that they invited, this cripple, the man with edema or abnormal swelling of his body, why did they invite him? He was clearly invited. He was in the house. The Pharisees invited him. He was in the Pharisees' house. A trap. So they might be wondering, all right, what's the catch? Why are you inviting me? So yes, they would have to beg them, plead with them to go. But then Constantine saw this word compel. After the Christians were no longer, or after the Christians gained power in Rome and became the official religion of Rome, he saw this word and he began forcing, through torture and murder, people to turn to God. Beginning with a reign of terror, he turned Christianity, something about love and about inviting people, letting God's love compel them, into a force thing. Now, if I pulled out a gun right now and I pointed it at you and told you to stand up, what would you do? You'd stand up. If I told you to sit down, what would you do? If I told you to stand on your head, what would you do? You'd try to stand on your head. But if I told you, love me, could you do it? So how stupid, I think I can say that he's centuries gone, how stupid must they have been to have thought that torturing people into confessing their love and devotion to God would have worked? It's pretty stupid. It's a no-brainer. It's not going to be authentic. But again, what was God's real message? In Genesis chapter 22, verse 18, it reads, "And through your offspring," this is talking to Abraham, "through your offspring," how many? "All nations on what? On earth will be blessed." Not just the Jewish nation. Pharisees, they had their confidence where? In the fact that they were descendants of Abraham? Their nationality? History? But no, this message was to go to all the nations of the world, that they could be blessed. A little story about Matthew chapter 5 as we're going into it. Matthew chapter 5 through 7 is the Sermon on the Mount. Martin Luther King didn't even really know about it. Now, who was Martin Luther King Jr.? He was a minister, Baptist minister, right? It took going to Gandhi, visiting Gandhi, for him to learn about the Sermon on the Mount. Who was Gandhi? Huh? He was a Buddhist. Hindu, thank you. He was a Hindu. Huh? A Gentile, okay. Yes. Hence, I like your Christ, I don't like your Christians. It took him going to Gandhi to learn about the real meaning behind the Sermon on the Mount. And so I'm going to take you there a little bit, parts of it, to describe what kind of guy Jesus really was. Because Jesus, as we've already seen, he likes to churn the waters a little bit, mix things up. But Matthew 5, verses 38 through 42, "You have heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth." Now these are laws in Moses' time. "But I say, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Now, this is where I will describe to you the difference between a pacifist and a pacifist. You can write those two words down. Pacifist is spelled P-A-C-I-F. I-S-T. Pacifist, instead of a C, has two S's. Now, if you are passive with a C, you're sitting back, you're meek, you're not interacting, you're not standing up, you're not causing a ruckus. Now, if you are passive with a double S, you can be causing ruckus, but you're doing it nonviolently. You're doing it peacefully. There can be a lot of arguments, but you're nonviolent. It's the difference between Martin Luther King and the Black Panthers, who I remember turning out at elections not too long ago with submachine guns. To compel, not coerce. And so here, this is a perfect example of it. When he said, if someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also, do you know what he meant? There was a difference in their time, in Palestine at that time, between the right hand and the left hand. The left hand was never used to touch someone. If you touched someone with the left hand, they were determined to be unclean because that left hand was used for all the dirty jobs. They didn't have anything for cleaning, including toilet paper. And so you were not to strike anyone with your left hand. There was a law in Deuteronomy that said that if you're going to strike someone, an equal, you do it with a closed fist. And so if someone was not your equal, you would then backhand them. So here, when Jesus is saying, if someone strikes you on the cheek, kind of picture it with me, I'm right-handed. If I'm going to punch you closed fist, it's going to be on your left cheek. But if I backhand you, it's going to be on which cheek? Your right cheek. If someone strikes you on the cheek, you stand up and you turn the other cheek. You say, no, if you're going to hit me, you're going to hit me as an equal. And with this issue of suing, if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. Do you know how many layers of clothing they wore? Two. So if someone wants your shirt, you give them everything. And in that case, what would they be doing? Would they have anything covering them? In their culture, if someone was naked, it was not shameful for the person who was naked. It was shameful for the people who saw you naked. And it was especially shameful if they made you naked. They had laws protecting them from being able to take their small clothes. You cannot take the last piece of article of clothing. And so if someone tries to take everything you have, you give them everything you have. And shame on them for it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between asking and suing. This is an issue of one Jew suing another Jew. They had debtor's prison where someone could go to repay it, pay a debt. You could force them to do that, but you couldn't take the shirt off their back, or their small clothes, essentially. Yes, but you have to understand that it's in a suing. So I'm going to sue you for the shirt off your back. Yeah, it's not a generosity thing. It's an issue of I'm taking from you through the legal system, yeah. But if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. There was a law set in motion that if you were an able-bodied Jew and someone of the Roman military came along, wanted you to carry their armor, they could make you carry their armor for up to 1 mile. But if they made you carry it for more than that, they were the ones to be punished. Now, that's really key, because it says here, if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. What is that soldier going to be doing? You reach the first mile, and there's the first mile line, and you take another step and another step, and you've still got their gear. What are they going to be doing? Please put down my armor, please. I'll do anything. Just put it down. You're going to get me in trouble. I'm going to get lashings. It paints a funny picture. But then imagine the situation that you would be in that case. You would be able to turn to them and say, don't worry about it. I got your back. It's all cool. If anyone tries to get you in trouble, I offered. You didn't force me. And then the talk that would ensue after that. He was not a pacifist of just going along and taking it. He stood up to make changes non-violently. It's that same kind of thing. Did you know that when Britain pulled out of India with Gandhi doing his thing of starving himself, when they pulled out, they said they issued orders to pull out as peacefully as possible because they didn't want to incur the wrath of Gandhi. It's a funny combination of words. Wrath of Gandhi. Matthew 22:36-40. Teacher, which is the greatest commandment? Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it. Love your who? Your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. But something you have to know, and it'll pick it up right here in verse 11, but the thing that you have to realize was that neighbor did not mean everyone. What did neighbor mean? It referred to their fellow Jew. So they essentially were taught, you can love your neighbor and love God, but it was okay to hate your enemy. So when Jesus answered this, they didn't have any problem with that. They were testing him on his knowledge, which they should have known because from the age of 12, it's accounted, they were wowed by his knowledge. But Jesus goes even further, and he says, you have heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. They didn't like that. Who were the Jews' enemies at the time? Rome. Romans. Even though a lot of them had sided with them in some ways, trying to use their power to gain power for themselves, their enemies were Rome, who conquered them, conquered the people who conquered them and so forth, but were oppressing them. When they looked forward to a Messiah, they were looking for someone who is going to conquer Rome and set up the Jews on top. But now he's saying, love them and pray for the Romans. More on the same topic. I tell you, not one of those who were invited will get a taste of my banquet. Now, that's going back to the same story, conclusion of the story. Why is that important? What the people who were initially invited to the banquet, who were they? The Jews, okay? I'm talking about the banquet and the story. His friends, probably other people in power, you would imagine. He's a man of power. They would assume that he had invited other people in power. People who they were not morally superior to. They're moral equals. But Jesus says that those people that were invited, that made up weak excuses, they're not going to get a taste of the banquet. something you have to realize is that the Pharisees, they had the kind of holiness that repelled people. Jesus, who he was, he had the kind of holiness that attracted sinners. Jesus didn't fit in their box because he called the outcasts, the sinners, the poor, the lame, his tribe. And that is why in Matthew 21, he told the Pharisees, "Truly I tell you, the tax collectors and the prostitutes are entering the kingdom ahead of you." Because he just wanted his house full. He just wanted his house full. If you feel like a religious outsider at any point, you feel like you're being looked down upon, and this can go for Christians and non-Christians. We've all felt judged by someone. If you feel like a religious outsider, the message that Jesus sends is that you're my tribe. He says it doesn't matter what you've done. It doesn't matter what your sins have been. Whether you gave up a child, whether you were an alcoholic or a meth addict, I don't care. You're my tribe. You're my people. Come, fill my house. Doesn't matter if you've done those things. Let's just start with dinner. Let's just have a bite to eat. The rest will come later. They'll come in time. But right now, let's just work on introducing ourselves, getting to know one another. But the neat thing is that Jesus didn't just eat with tax collectors and sinners. He also ate with the Pharisees, which gives me hope. Because I didn't grow up like Loretta did. I grew up in the church. And if you're a Christian here today, and I know that many of you are, how many of you have seen a slightly different picture of who Jesus was? Someone who didn't look down on people, who just says, "I want you to be a part of my tribe. I want to get to know you." How many of you would want to follow a Jesus like that more than a religion? He's extending that hand to us, to all of us, because we're all sinners. We're not morally superior to anyone because all have sinned. And today we invite everyone here to join us. It's not a full dinner, but it's some healthy snacks and things to be able to sit and hang out and talk for a little bit before we head on out. What time is it? Okay. Hopefully tomorrow night we'll start a little bit earlier. First night always starts a little late and goes a little late. But we'll have a 10-15 minutes to be able to hang out and talk. So you're welcome to stay. Thank you.